you doing, everyone? I'm Russ Salzberg, and I want you all to listen up and get a load of this. Joining me is one of the great newspaper men to ever cover the streets of this city. I'm talking about Dennis Hamill. So what you've got here are two Brooklyn guys just hanging out, sitting on a stoop, and shooting a breeze. So like I said, listen up, because you're really going to want to get a load of this. All right. As I said, one of the great newspaper men to ever cover the streets of this city, and I am not just saying this, Dennis Hamill just had a knack, as did his older brother, Pete Hamill, just knowing how to deal with the people. He's a Brooklyn guy just like myself, and Den, it is a pleasure to have you here with me today.
Well, this is terrific to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, listen, and, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted to start talking with you, just because, and I should also say, folks, you know Dennis from all the great work he did with the New York Daily News, but because he's no longer with the news, which is their numbskull ideas, but you can still get him if you look online at the East Hampton Independent, and his work is not as good, it's better than ever. So having said that, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you flat out, what the hell has happened to our industry? And when I say our industry, you're from the print side, I'm from the electronic side, and a lot of it has gone, for lack of a better term, to the shithouse.
It sure has, and I think a lot of it has to do with no longer making the focus on local news. I think that we learned this business by covering the city that we grew up in, and for us it was the capital of the world, so we covered everything we did was a national or an international story because it was New York. But we went out into the streets, into the neighborhoods, and we covered the a place that has 8 million people and 183 different ethnic groups and or nationalities and different races and religions. It was the most diverse city in the world. And then we flattened it out into a way of covering news that with clicks and the internet to make everything sound like area code 800. You know, it doesn't, you lost all the local flavor. Yeah. You lost, you know, I always said about Brooklyn that it lost its character when it lost its characters. When people who could no longer afford to live there had to pack up and leave because the rents went through the roof from gentrification, you lost the magic of the place. But I do think that, you know, getting back to basics and covering local news first, because all politics is local. I mean, all crime is local. And, you know, all education and health is local. So when you cover the way I used to cover a city like New York for a newspaper like the Daily News, you really spoke to the common person who were dealing with these bread and butter issues. And we've lost that. It's now a divided country where you have red and blue restaurants, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, we're going to get to water fountains.
Well, we're laughing, but it's no joke. That's exactly what you do have right now.
I mean, it's preposterous. So, you used to be able to have a lively debate in a barroom or a laundromat or a hairdresser in the city, but now that can dissolve into a fistfight and a brawl.
Well, having said that, you know, fistfight and a brawl, and you also said mentioned blue and red restaurants. You know, the one thing that I find in the media, and I think you feel the same way. Listen, you could be a liberal, I could be a conservative, which I'm not, but you can be Republican, I can be Democrat.
You're like a moderate.
No. But what I'm saying to you is, what I'm finding in the media today, that includes your end, the print end, I'm including my end, the electronics end, and that's where I think the media is making. First of all, I don't like the media is not the enemy. We know that's nonsense. But I think a lot of the problem with the media today is, much like the public, they write or report with an agenda as opposed to just giving you the straight story.
Well, I think that's certainly the case on TV and cable news. It's gone into opposite corners, like in a boxing ring, you know, where we actually have a red and a blue corner. but I don't. I think in the mainstream newspapers, there's still some really excellent reporting going on. And I mean, a lot of people accuse the New York Times of just being a liberal bastion, but they go through acres of levels of editing and vetting there when they get their sources. And those sources are not coming from the left. Most of the leaks they're getting are coming from inside the White House and from inside the administration. So the stuff that you've been reading in the Washington Post and the New York Times, which each won a Pulitzer Prize this year, for their reporting out of Washington, most of that reporting is based on people that are part of the current administration. You can't blame the reporters. You can't shoot the messenger for bringing you the news. You just cannot do that. And most of this stuff has stood up. To label it as fake news and to start calling reporters the enemy of the people is dangerous. I think it has created a climate. I don't blame at Donald Trump or this administration for the shootings in Annapolis 2 weeks ago, where the brother of a good friend of mine was murdered in a newsroom. But certainly they have responsibility for the climate they have created. They have tried to demonize the news and the reporters that collect it as somehow enemies of the United States of America. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Getting back to what we were talking about, you made a comment before. Brooklyn's character changed when it lost its characters.
Right.
I never wanted to be one of those guys who, I got older, said, in my day, it was better. But I'm telling you, in my day, Brooklyn was better. There was something, as I opened up saying, you and I are sitting here, going to be two guys sitting on a stoop just shooting the breeze. There were characters at every corner,
right.
Be it the corner candy store, the luncheonette, wherever it was, there were characters. And
it was magical in that way.
It was magical.
And, there's this, what we're missing, and when I was growing up in Brooklyn, it was before everybody had air conditioning. The only place that had air conditioning when I was growing up was the movie house where my mother was a cashier.
Well, I know I was growing up in a housing project. There certainly wasn't central air or central vacuum.
And I lived in a housing project, too. Mostly in a tenement. Then we moved up in the world to a housing project where there were elevators and bedrooms with doors on and a shower. So we thought we moved up in the world when we moved to the project because there was heat all the time and hot water. But what happened in the streets of Brooklyn was people, when it got unbearably hot, we used to sleep out on the fire escape because it was cool. We used to put blankets on the fire escape and sleep out there and or up on the roof or where there was a pigeon coop and pebbles and all that. And then at nighttime, people would take folding chairs and milk boxes and go and sit outside their tenement or on their stoops. And people would gather and just gab and talk. And it was a wonderful place, and everybody knew all the neighbors, and they all either liked or didn't like each other, but there were cliques, yes, there were. But the streets were filled with people, and there was a famous urbanologist named Jane Jacobs in the Greenwich Village, and she wrote a great book called The Life and Death of American Cities, where she talked about the density of people on the streets keep the city safe. And there used to be all these people out. It was impossible to commit a crime. There were all those people out in the streets sitting on milk boxes, and their kids were playing Ringolivio, and they were, you know.
Johnny on the Pony. Listen, I know when I was a kid, and I'm talking about 8 years old. No, 9 years old. We moved into the projects from the Bronx when I was 9 years old. Summertime, you went down in the morning, roughly 7:30. You stayed down till 12 o'clock, noontime. You went up for lunch. Then I came down at 20 to 1. Charlie, the ice cream guy, was coming by ringing the bell. We got our ice cream. Then we stayed out till about 5:30. My old man would whistle from the window to come up for dinner. We had supper for an hour, went back down till it was dark, and that was it. And you know what? There was no phones. Nobody was looking for you.
No.
it just changed.
There was no such thing as a play date. My old man's idea of a play date was get out and don't come back till dinner. and that meant that we were out playing stickball off the point. And what happened was that when you saw all those kids playing stickball, playing punchball, playing street games, they weren't doing burglaries. They weren't doing dope. They weren't doing anything but hanging out. We would sit on stoops when in between games and share sodas. And we would look at the big buildings across the river and dream about going to Manhattan when we grew up. That was ours.
And every parent knew whose kid was whose kid, absolutely, who belonged to who. And it was almost like every parent, listen, if my kid gets out of line, if Dennis gets out of line or Russ gets out of line, you want to give him a boot in the ass? Or that's the way it was. It was different. You know what? You know this nut that we saw on the subway recently, hit somebody with a pipe. I remember, and I think I've spoken about this with you, privately. I was 9 years old. I got on a bus, took the 36 Surf Avenue bus to the Sheepshead Bay station. I got on the train and met my father because somebody gave him freebie tickets up at the Bronx to go to a Yankee game. Okay. I mean, this was before the Mets came to town. So it was up going to a Yankee game, and it was like, huh? Think about that. And here was a 9-year-old kid traveling
from Brooklyn going to a Yankee game
in the Bronx. And that was the norm. It wasn't like my parents were like, being casual about my safety. All kids did that. That was the norm. Now, I mean, what is it? Carpooling, you're taking your kid to school to go 10 blocks. It's just different.
It's just a completely different city. And yet the crime rate is as low as it was when we were kids. And a lot of it is the hysteria that's created by cable news and the 24-hour news cycle. We got one news cycle, two news cycles a day. The late box scores and the morning paper. We got the paper. Everybody used to come out at night to wait for the daily news. In the evening,
people waited for the early daily news at late at night, and I couldn't wait because I was an LA Dodgers fan before the Mets came into being, and the Koufax Dodgers were my Dodgers, so you'd wait for the Post, which was the afternoon paper. That's you'd right. wait for the Post to get the box scores.
That's exactly right, because they didn't come in, and it was a completely different city, and we had an infinite amount of fun. I mean, it was just...
Let me ask you this then, Dennis, as a newspaper man. You kind of touched on it. You beat me to it. There's almost too much news today. And because there's almost too much news with all the cable stations and social media as well, do you think there's a situation where people are just rushing to be first to get it out? Well, listen, we all want to break stories, but you think there's a rush to get it first as opposed to being the rush to get it right?
No, I agree with that. I think there's that whole rush to get it out first is crazy, and it's a stampede, and it makes people very nervous, and they go with stories that are half-cooked sometimes, and you have to play catch-up ball on it later because of that panic. And then they also want national stories. I mean, the Daily News went online, they wanted stories that people around the country and the world were going to click on. They weren't going to click on the pizzeria being driven out of business by gentrification in Sunset Park. They weren't going to click on that. They're going to click on Kardashian, or Kardashian's ass all of a sudden became, the big clickbait in the country. And, I wasn't going to write about that kind of stuff. I mean, I had no interest in it. And gossip sort of dominated hard news. And the reason why the Trump administration has been covered in an endless loop constantly, every hour on the hour, is because he comes out of reality television.
Without question.
And so that he even designs his day like a television show, the way he unveiled a Supreme Court judge was almost like, naming who the survivor or who's going to be left on the island in Survivor. It's like it's crazy, and so that it becomes like a TV performance, like a TV show instead of a presidency. And then, you know, there's people that take sides, like they do the Mets and the Yankees. And some people, there's just such division. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, you talk about the division. last week, I was promoting my podcast.
Right.
So, and I just told people, you know, check it out. I'm going to be talking about this today. And that's all I did. And then I looked on Facebook and the vitriol that was going on back and forth, just, oh, is Russ going to be, is it going to be to the right? Is it going to be to the left? I criticized, a couple of weeks ago, I criticized Peter Fonda for what he said. I mean, you know, paraphrasing now, Baron Trump ought to be ripped from his mother's arms and put in a cage with pedophiles. Now,
there is no right and left on that.
You see? Thank you. I would criticize anybody for saying that. And I said, Fonda ought to be taken in to a dark alley in the street and have his teeth kicked in. The vitriol that I received on Facebook, why are you picking on him? Who cares what he says? So when I say, well, who cares what he said? Did you say the same thing about Roseanne Barr or would a dope Kathy Griffin, which both of them got what they deserved? But there's not a wrong and a right. There's strictly wrong with that business. Right. But the left looks at it one way, the right looks at it another way. And quite frankly, I'm sick to my stomach over it.
Because
you and I grew up in the 60s, so we know what division's about, but I have never seen a division like I see it in this country today.
But you know what? When I was coming up in journalism, that wouldn't have even made news. I mean, it would have been a blip. I mean, you know, you wouldn't waste the ink on it because it was insignificant. Who would have given a shit about what Peter Fonda had to say or Roseanne Barr or any of these people? But social media has taken it to a new level. People cover tweets. I mean, it's insane. They don't cover events. They cover tweets.
Not only do they cover tweets, I'm sure the editors sitting in a newspaper, I've seen it being in a TV newsroom, somebody tweeted out and you're going chasing your tail over a tweet.
It's insane. I mean, I teach journalism at Brooklyn College and I still encourage students that there's no substitute for a good pair of shoes, good pair of walking shoes for a reporter, where you go in person to show up, take a look, talk to people, write down what you see, what you hear, what you smell, and especially what people say and what the scene looks like. Knock on doors, climb extra flights of stairs, make the extra phone call, go to a neighbor, and then if you're a good reporter, you're going to bring the reader. You Are, there used to be a great show called You Are There. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
But that's because somebody, my job is to go and gather the news and present it in a readable, entertaining story that's also informative to all the people that do other jobs for a living who are reading the daily news on the subway on the way to work. And we're losing that common thread where people were getting reports from people that they could rely on. It didn't matter whether people agreed with my politics. They knew I would go places and look at things. So even people who didn't agree with my politics would read my column because they knew there was an authenticity to it. I grew up in the city. I spoke the same idiom. I knew the slang and I knew the back alleys and I knew the cops and the neighbors and the bartenders and the people in the neighborhood. I knew how to speak to them. And I would bring you the news that they could rely on.
Let me stop you right there. You just said something. I knew how to speak with them.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a lost art? Because that's what I'm finding.
Yeah.
People, I'll give you another example. Kids ask me about advice, you know, in the business, getting into the business. So I always say, I use the term, just what you said. What did you say about the shoes? You got
a comfortable pair of shoes. Yeah.
Okay. I always say, you got to go knock at doors and you got to get your foot in the door. And they say to me, well, I sent it out, my resume by email. And I go, yeah. Well, do you follow it up with a phone call and go knock at the door? Well, no. You're a person. Let them know who the hell you are.
Exactly.
Don't say this is the rule, that this is how we do it now by email. Go. Knock at the door. Let them know who that person is. Show them your aggressiveness. Show them that you give a shit, that you care.
Yeah, especially about yourself.
Yeah.
And that you have personality and that you have some balls, that you're going to go out and do it and present yourself. You're going to sell yourself and you're going to be that aggressive for the company. So you need to do that. But when you ask me how do you speak to people in the journalism class, my advice to all these young kids is, don't go up with a notebook and start asking people personal questions. Start it with a conversation. Leave the notebook in your pocket for a minute. Then start talking to them about things that they are experts on, their jobs and their kids. And then when you were talking about an event that happened on their block, did you see what happened down the block the other day where there was these people had a fight and it spilled out into the gutter? Yeah. Do you mind talking to me? I work for the Daily News, and I'm here trying to find that out. Then they feel comfortable with you.
They trust you.
I said, do you mind if I take your name and ask you some quotes? I'll talk to you, but I don't want to use my name. Okay, I won't use your name, but just give me your first name. All right, give me your first name. By the end of the conversation, they say, you know what? You can use my name because they trust you. And, but if they don't know who you are and you come off like some kid out of an Ivy League J school, and you're dressed with a bow tie and a pair of of Gucci loafers, they're not gonna feel comfortable.
They want you to be a real person.
They want to be able to identify with you.
The biggest compliment that I get in the business, when people meet me, they go, Russ, you're really like you are on TV.
Yeah.
You're a regular guy. And my answer always to that is, well, what the hell am I supposed to be?
Yeah.
but listen, and I'm the first one to say it. A lot of people, especially on the TV end of the business, are the blow dry. But that goes for male and female. Mm-hmm. And you got to be a real person. You got to talk to people.
Absolutely, and that's what people identify with, and that's what will make them return to your byline. And we're losing, just like we're losing the characters in the places like Brooklyn, and that therefore we're losing the character. When you have newspapers that no longer have a Jimmy Breslin or a Pete Hamill.
Or a Dennis Hamill. Don't sell yourself short, buddy.
People that would go to you because you were a personality and that you gave them some flavor. Even if they didn't agree with you, sometimes people would read me just to feed their rage. That's okay. I listen to talk radio all the time. I sit in the car by myself screaming at the radio, and I put on Fox News to drive myself crazy too, but I also want to hear the other side of the story. So I appreciate that, and people like that about me. And then if they meet me, most of them say, I don't always agree with you, but I at least you go out and cover the stories and you do show up. And that's the one thing that I prided myself on, is that I didn't sit on my ass in the newsroom because there are no new stories in the newsroom. I went out into the city. I almost never went to the newsroom. I would go out in different places, talk to people, cover events, talk to people live the way you wanted me to come in person today into the studio.
Exactly. What I say, I said, Dennis,
it's a different dynamic.
We can do it on the phone, but if you come in, it's different. We're sitting looking at each other. I'm looking at you.
And I'm reading. You're reading body language. Right. You're looking at each other's eyes. We're making each other laugh. We smile. We use hand gestures. It's a different thing. And when you show up and people feel that you have taken the effort to go and travel to their neighborhood, to their street, to their address, and talk to them in their corner saloon, they like that. They think that you care about them, and then they'll open up to you. That's the kind of journalism we're missing.
Now, you and I were brought up, we're the same age. You and I were brought up in a different era where you say characters. We were characters, and we all knew, as most people did from our era, the art of schmoozing, be able to sit, as I say, and shoot the breeze. And I'm wondering if that is becoming a lost art.
People do it online now. They do it on Facebook. They do it on Twitter. They do it on Snapchat. And so they don't see each other. But we used to sit on a stoop right next to each other. And that's where guys and girls would meet and date and do that.
Yeah.
And I guess now they exchange photographs, and I don't know what they do. They say, we're not going out. We're talking to each other. So I don't understand all of it, but that's because I'm getting old. I mean, I'm already old. But they just do it in social media. And it can't be as much fun.
Right.
To me, I used to love to watch Danny Aiello when he always had an expensive Cadillac. If he would park it on the street, he would get out of the car and yell up to the roof, up to the top floor, "Angelo, keep an eye on the car."
You're right.
You might want to let the people in the neighborhood think there was somebody watching his car so the hubcaps didn't go missing.
We're talking about us, and we're talking about, with two Brooklyn guys, the famous steak place, Peter Luger's, Williamsburg. You used to go. Now, with things are fancy, everything's gentrified, there's a parking lot, it's safer. You used to go, and you used to have to give the guy a $5 bill, the old man sitting in front of the restaurant, because if you left it there, and he was not watching a car, when you walked out of the place, it was on 4 milk boxes.
That's right. That's exactly right. The city has changed. You know, I mean, I can't tell you, now Williamsburg is a neighborhood that you can't afford to live in.
Listen, I went to high school at Brooklyn Tech, okay? I think Spike Lee once, because I think his parents were from that area, I think they bought a brownstone, which was maybe for $40,000, which grew to like $4 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, you can't buy in that area.
Fort Greene.
Yeah, Fort Greene. Yeah. That's the Fort Greene area.
Yeah. And then, you know, he was talking about that Fort Greene Park. It looked like the Kensington Dog Show. Or
oh, my God.
It's so gentrified now that, you know, I don't know where people that like us are living now. I mean, while we lived in the projects, there's still people living
right.
in the projects. But I don't know where the affordable housing is, and I still think that's one of the great crises of the city, and which is going to make the city a two-tiered town, because you're either going to be very poor or very rich to live here. It's really tough. I watch, you know, young people. They all have to live together. They kick in $1,000 each to live in three bedrooms in Bushwick.
Lexi, our producer, is smiling, laughing at me because she's been doing the same thing. Listen, I've got two married daughters, okay? They're in the 30s. I remember when they got out of college and they were first jobs and they were living in the city, each had roommates. And first of all, a one-bedroom apartment was cut into two bedrooms, or a two was divided into three. And you know what my first apartment, I got out of college, I was living on 53rd Street between 1st and 2nd. Now, that's a pretty good area. Today, it was great then. A big studio apartment with an alcove kitchen, like really nice. I mean, it was big. $210 a month. Mm. You can't park your bicycle for $210 a month. The world has changed. And kids, I'll give you another example. When you and I started working, I just wanted a job. I just wanted a job to start making my own money. In fairness to kids today, you know, we're talking about life has changed, but in fairness to kids today, they start working, they got to worry about health insurance, you know, the medical insurance. And your parents tell you, you have to ask about those things. We were not concerned about those things. It's a different world for them. And plus, the other thing, when you and I went to college, I mean, let's say you flunked something or what, or first of all, a lot of people went to college at night, and I'm talking about even med school or law school, went to college at night. Today, kids graduate. It is normal to graduate with $100,000 in student loans. Easily $100,000 in student
Usually
loans.
Usually two.
That's right. Usually two. Yeah. At least 100. I can't tell you how many interns have spoken to me, I'm doing okay, Russ, and, you know, I'm going to make it, and I'm proud of them, and I've recommended them for jobs, but $165,000 in student
loans.
You're
paying off student loans until you get a half fare card for the subway.
When you talk about stuff that needs to be fixed in this country, that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
The price of higher education is absolutely, and it's prejudicial. But you know what? It's not just for lower income. Parents work their whole life busting their ass to make it make ends meet for their kids, the kids to go to school, to do this and that, and they're paying loans up the yin yang.
I mean, I went to CUNY and I teach at CUNY, and everybody in my family went to CUNY. So, to me, CUNY is still just a great bargain and has some really good teachers. But It's cheap. It's $6,000 compared to $50,000.
Still
other
today,
places.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, that is an alternative, and the school is good, but a lot of people just want to get away and go to, you know, the whole thing is to be like you make a school. It's almost like it's like making a professional sports team or something. So you feel compelled to go and take out a $50,000 loan.
I was graduating high school back in the day, which was 1969, I graduated Brooklyn Tech, which was, to this day, it's still one of the better high schools in the country, public school.
I had a brother who went there.
Right. Your brother not only went there, wasn't he part of NASA?
Yeah, he worked for NASA.
Worked for NASA. Okay. Yeah. I'm graduating. My father was dying at the time. You know, I'm living in a housing project. And, you know, I remember my parents, because we didn't have a car. And my mother said to me, you know, Russ, if you want to stay home, you know, we'll manage to get you a car, you know, because my father was sick. And I said, Ma, you know what? If God forbid something's going to happen, I'm a plane ride away. I just felt I needed to get away. But I went to college because somebody invited me. You know, I went up to see the school. I went to college in Montreal. Room Loyola. So people used to say, what's a Jewish guy doing in, you know, a Jesuit college? And, you know, right away my father says, that's where he's going because the priests won't take any crap. You know, they're not burning draft cards. Dad, it's Canada. They're not, you know.
They don't have draft cards.
But room, board, and tuition, a beautiful school. Room, board, and tuition, $1,350. Room, board, and tuition for the year. My mother, let her rest in peace, used to send me, because my father died just before I was going to college. My mother used to send me $65 a month. Why 65? Because at that time, the Canadian dollar was worth more than the American dollar. So the 65 came into 60, and I had $15 a week spending money. Plus what I can hustle.
Living
large, and plus what I can hustle on my own. Yeah. And you know what? Then we were happier than a pig in slop.
Well, I was, you know, I went to Staten Island Community College and Richmond College before they merged into the College of Staten Island, and it was a great experience. I took filmmaking and studied literature, and I came out and made money and made a living in journalism, writing, publishing 10 novels and writing movies. I mean, so I got that from going to CUNY. I didn't go to NYU. I have a daughter who went to NYU. I didn't go to NYU. It wasn't even discussed.
Right. Yeah, right.
you're going to community college.
Yeah. You know? I mean, and quite frankly, so many kids that we knew went to community college. And you know what? If parents and kids are listening to this right now, there still is no shame in going to community college. Take care of the 2 years. It doesn't strangle you with what you're going to have to pay when you get into that better school. But there's nothing wrong with going to a community college.
When I got out of college, I had $1,500 in student loans. And I used that to have parties.
I want to get back to the education thing. But you know, we also were talking about the newspapers. And I want to ask you this. I have a theory. I don't think I've ever discussed it with you. I feel this way. I think, and we all know that the newspapers are in trouble. The newspaper industry is in dire straits. And I feel one of the reasons is in dire straits, they've done it to themselves. Why do I say that? If all the newspapers, for example, like we talk about the Times, the Post, the Daily News, whatever the hell else there is, if they all could have gotten together and said, look, let's all agree. And maybe this is naivete on my part, but maybe if they would have said to one another, you know, let's not put any of our stuff out on the internet. Let's not have our news, what we are writing, let's not have it on the internet. Let's all agree that we're going to stick together on this. And the reason I'm saying that they would make the people buy the newspapers. Is that being naive on my part?
Yeah, because what happened was that that New Ventures started online, just like the Huffington Post, that were only online, and Slate Magazine and the Daily Beast and all of that. So if you weren't online, so you people were going to get their news for free online and just ignore you altogether. So the only way to catch eyeballs and try to chase the dollar was by putting your own paper online. Now, the papers that the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all have made a lot of money by putting up a paywall online. Right. Where you have to pay to read it.
Right.
You know, or you have to be a subscriber, which gives you the password to read it online. Newsday does it in Long Island. I don't know if they're making money off it, but I know that Wall Street Journal has a specified kind of audience. But the Washington Post and New York Times, it saved those two newspapers. Going online saved those papers and made them. They're now in profit. They're, you know,
interesting.
I think Trump helped that. He has helped solve a lot of papers.
You know what? Listen, let me tell you something.
He sells papers.
He sells papers and news. He helps the news industry, electronic and print. That's for sure.
And it's symbiotic. I mean, yes. they got him elected, and they gave him. They covered everything he did.
Whether he thinks it's fake news or not, they got him elected.
No, and he loved it. I mean, he loves attention. So he every single rally, every single comment, every single tweet was covered. And so he didn't have to pay any money for advertising. He didn't need any Trump commercials. He was on the air constantly. So, I mean, you know, on all the cable news all day long, on all the network news all day long. He was in the front page of every newspaper every single day, which he always wanted to be. He used to call up places like the Daily News and pretend that he was, you know, his own press agent, pitching stories about who he was sleeping with, you know. So, I mean, you know, to say that he doesn't like the media is crazy. He's a media creation. But it is symbiotic. I mean, he benefited from it and they benefited from him. And then, you know, we are where we are now. I mean, you know, he has found it convenient to label them as the enemy because it works with his base. But, you know, he still calls up the New York Times. When he wants to do a major interview, he calls up the New York Times, you know. He still talks to Maggie Haberman or somebody who used to work for the Daily News.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And her brother, Zach Haberman, is like the city editor, the managing editor.
Wait, you mentioned something. You know, people, like, you teach journalism, but you also teach, correct me if I'm wrong, screenwriting?
Yeah, I teach screenwriting at
Brooklyn College.
Brooklyn College has its own cinema school, a graduate school. Yeah, and it's located down at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It's a wonderful facility with all the most modern technology, motion capture and animation. And, you know, I teach screenwriting there because I've written several movies. And it's amazing to go into these classes. I had a screenwriting class last year where there was a woman writing a script that took place in Lahore in Pakistan.
I just want to interrupt you for 1 second. Are most of your students, because this is a graduate class, are most of your students lower income kids from the city or?
No, actually, I had kids that were, you know, who graduated from Sarah Lawrence, Harvard.
Oh, wow.
Columbia, all kinds of. But when they wanted to go to graduate school, they were already in debt from undergrad. And to go to NYU to Tisch, you would have had to spend another $60,000 a semester. So at CUNY, it's 16 for graduate school. And, you know, and we have, you know, the guy, you know, we have people that have made movies and that have written movies like myself who are actually teaching the craft. And so they get a really terrific education for a whole lot less money, and it's located right next to the Steiner Studio. So all the movies and TV shows that are being made all around us, right down there. So,
so
great environment.
When you're teaching, listen, covering the streets, being a newspaper writer is one thing, as you said, get uncomfortable shoes, go out and do your thing and talk to people. Excuse me, but screenwriting. How do you teach a kid, a young person, to be a screenwriter?
Well, it's a craft, and as is journalism. But the thing that you can't teach is imagination, and you can't teach passion. But you can certainly teach the craft. It's an actual craft, and you And I started with last year in a course called Narrative Structure, where I went back and made them all read Plato's Poetics. So that, you know, the basic principles of drama have not changed over the years. There's like 36, you know, plot lines, really, that we also, you know, reinvent. And there's a process and a formula for writing a screenplay. I mean, you know, a movie has to capture your imagination in the first 7 minutes. And by the end of 15 minutes, we have to know what the character is after, but there has to be and then there's an act change at the end of act one, has to end a big dramatic turn. The second act is all kinds of conflict. And then the third act, which is about 90 pages in, goes resolution in the last 30 pages. And that hasn't changed, but there's ways to teach that in a classroom, and to teach people how to shorten their dialogue and even their description to make a movie, to make a screenplay pop and move, because we call them movies because they move, but you want a screenplay to move too, because you don't want to sit there and be weighted down with too many words. You want the thing to move and pop along. You know?
Do you talk to the kids, students, kids? Do you talk to them, because, listen, they want to be in movie makers. Do you tell them, listen, movies can still be made. The acting is the thing. And the reason I say that, the other night, I happened to catch it at its very beginning. I've seen it several times. It was on, my favorite channel, TCM. 12 Angry Men, the one with Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb and Ed Begley and Martin Paulson. It was a who's who cast. And basically, Jack Klugman, Jack Warden, it's a who's who's cast, 12 men sitting in a room, it's a jury, 12 men sitting in a room. And I looked and I called my wife, in, and she had seen it. And I said, but this is the clear cut example of, you don't need the bells and whistles. You just need the script and the people carrying out the script.
It starts with the script. Right. If it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage, is the old line. It starts with the screenplay. Everything else revolves around it. And if you have you can't make a good movie with a bad script. You really have to start with a screenplay that's worthwhile. And then in the case of 12 Angry Men, they happened to have the magic of Sidney Lumet directing it. And then they had, Henry Fonda and all that whole cast you just mentioned. But it was Reginald.
Who wrote it?
Reginald, what's his name?
Rose?
Yeah, Reginald Rose. Rose. And I interviewed him when they remade it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed him when William Friedkin remade it in 1998. And I asked him what the genesis of it was, and he told me, and I did this for the Daily News, and William Friedkin is a great film director who directed The French Connection, which to me is the best cop movie ever made. But and then he did this remake. But I interviewed Reginald Rose, and I asked him what was the genesis of the story. He said, I got called for jury duty. I went down to 100 Center Street. And I looked around and I said, boy, we were on a manslaughter case. And we were screaming and yelling at each other in the jury room. And I said to myself, this would be a great idea for a television show. Because he was working on one of those Playhouse 90s or something like that. It was I think it was CBS, actually. It was a one-hour one. I forget the name of the show. And like Philco Theater or something like that.
Right. Well, we're dating ourselves, but before 12 Angry Men hit the big screen, wasn't it a Playhouse 90?
Yeah, it was. It was in 1954, 3 years before that. It was a one-hour drama on television. And he wrote the script for that. And Henry Fonda, who was in it, said, we should make a movie out of this. Can you expand the script to a full-length movie? And he said yes, and he did. And it became a classic. It didn't make money when it first came out. But it became a cult classic over the years. It won all kinds of Academy Awards. But it was only after it announced that the awards that it started to make sense.
The way you said that, he was in was called for jury duty. I'm not saying on the waterfront happened exactly that way. But what the genesis or the idea behind On the Waterfront was, I wanted real people, and they used a lot of real people.
Oh, they sure did, and it was based on newspaper stories, by the way. They, you know, ran in the Sun and won Pulitzer Prizes, and they brought in Bud Schulberg, who had written What Makes Sammy Run. Ilya Kazan directed that, and he wanted Bud Schulberg to come and write the script. And he promised him that it would be that he would be honor his script, that he wouldn't Hollywoodize it. And so when he wrote it, I mean, Bud Schulberg went around pretending to be a boxing promoter and walked around the docks in Hoboken on the west side of Manhattan, telling people all these bullshit stories so he could get the real story. And he got people to talk to him. Like I said, they started conversations. And he really got the sense of what it was like and having to deal with the gangsters on the docks and all of that. And so he wrote a tremendous screenplay.
Well, is screenwriting, Dennis, is it similar? I mean, it's a tremendous craft.
Yeah, it's storytelling.
But do you need to do what you said to your students in the journalism class to get soft shoes? To be a good screenwriter, do you also have to go out into the street and learn?
Or base your first stories on personal experience so that you're an expert on. Or if you're going to do science fiction, make sure it's your own and not derivative. But there's a thing. I mean, in the beginning, all writers emulate, and then you're supposed to, you imitate, then you emulate, and then you surpass. You should, and when you find your own voice, you should be on your own. But that's what school is for. It's okay to do that in student films.
I heard this. It just flashed in my mind the way you described that. I guess that goes into a little bit of with acting, not that you're teaching an acting class, but I remember two people distinctly, Billy Bob Thornton.
Right.
I remember him being interviewed, and, you know, he's from Arkansas, and he said,
good actor.
You know, very good actor. And he said, listen, you know, Sling Blade. And
he wrote that.
Right.
So,
yeah. And won the Academy Award. Sling Blade and what was it, Monster or Monster Ball?
I think it's Monster Ball.
Monster Ball with Heath Ledger and black actress who won the Academy Award. Beautiful girl.
Oh, she's beautiful. What's her name?
Oh, that's terrible. I forgot her name. I'll remember. But he said he says, I know from these people. You know, like, I know, so I know how to act like that. And Hilary Swank, you know, she's from a trailer park.
Yeah.
And it's no secret that why she won for Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah.
Because she knew how, it was kind of in their blood.
Yeah, yeah. And if you can cast things where you get people that have a familiarity with that world, you will certainly, benefit from it. I mean, I always thought that when you have a screenplay with a 718 area code, don't cast actors from area code 818, you know, which is Hollywood, you know. So you make sure that you get people that sound like New York to be in it. when you get these kind of blonde underwear model types that, you know, that they want to cast, you know, and then make you think that they're... that it's a New York story. It doesn't work.
Yeah, there's a thing, you know, and I say this all the time. You need to know who you are.
Yeah. You know, when they were doing the French Connection, speaking of Billy Friedkin, long before Gene Hackman was cast, they were going to go with, they turned down, the studio turned down Jackie Gleason. And Billy Friedkin was upset about that. He really wanted Jackie Gleason to play Popeye Doyle.
Really?
Yeah. And then they were going to use Jimmy Breslin. And they were going, and Breslin was the leading character to play Popeye Doyle, up until that Billy Friedkin found out that Jimmy Breslin did not know how to drive, so he couldn't possibly have done the great chasing in that movie.
But you know, I mean, he doesn't get enough credit. Let him rest in peace. Jackie Gleason was a very good actor,
a
very, very good actor. But I just, when you see Popeye Doyle, I mean.
Hackman.
Yeah, I mean, it was just...
And Hackman didn't like the character, he thought he was a racist and he didn't want to play him and all that. And they had a tough time with it. At the time...
Halle Berry. I just came into my mind. Halle
Gorgeous.
Berry. It was a beautiful girl.
Actress.
Yeah.
But at the time, Hackman was a struggling actor who was living with another struggling actor named Bobby Duvall and another struggling actor named Dustin Hoffman.
That's not a bad trio.
No, those are the three guys.
They made out okay.
You're talking about roommates. They were struggling actors who were waiters in Manhattan and, you know, living in a roach-infested dump. And, you know, all three of them became Academy Award-winning.
Think about that.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, they should put a plaque outside that apartment building, whatever the hell it was.
I mean, when you think about three guys like that, just, well, look, again, you're here, and it is still Brooklyn that you and I talk, when we talk, it always reverts back to when we were kids.
Yeah, like the Mets have. It's 1962 all over again.
Yeah,
and I'm sitting on the roof with my old man with the Panasonic transistor with the antenna pointed towards the Empire State Building to pick up the signal.
Now you see me. It was a different story because mine were the L.A. Dodgers. I would religiously fall asleep every night with the transistor radio and the earplug in my ear and. Yeah. My mother or father would walk in and have to take it out of my ear because I had fallen asleep because the game was first starting at 11 o'clock New York time.
Yeah, well, my old man was a fanatical Dodger fan. He became an American by rooting. My dad was from the other side. He was from Belfast, Northern Ireland. He was a soccer player and a boxer. And, you know, and then he lost his leg in a terrible accident playing soccer. He got sepsis, and they had to take his leg off in Kings County. But he grew up as a big sports fan, and becoming a Dodger fan made him an American by learning the game, all the intricacies of that game. It's very hard for an immigrant to understand all those rules.
Right.
My mom never understood a single bit of it, but my dad and loved the Dodgers, rooted for the Dodgers, lived and breathed the Dodgers, read the sporting news religiously to get every single word about them. And then when they left New York, well, my brothers and I, we all thought that there was this great evil person named Son of a Bitch O'Malley. We thought that was the guy's name. That Son of a Bitch O'Malley, that's all we would hear all around that. Because, you know, one of his own, you know, an Irishman, took my dad's beloved American baseball team out of Brooklyn and brought them out to L.A.
And the thing about the Dodgers then, which people don't remember, they really were part of the neighborhood. I mean, they took, they lived in Bay Ridge. They lived in the areas. They took the train.
Robinson lived on Brooklyn Avenue.
Let him rest in peace. Gil Hodges, Joan Hodges, who today I remain very close with her, she still lives in their house on Bedford Avenue.
And then when the Mets happened, I live in Bayside, Queens. Tom Siebel lived in Bayside. And people used to come all day long and bring balls and give them to his wife, and then when he would come home, he would sign them all, and you would have to go back the next day to go and collect the ball. And all those people in Bayside, I didn't go up there, but I know these guys. They would go, and they still have those balls.
Really?
Yeah, he was terrific to the people, kids in the neighborhood. Yeah.
But now Bayside was a little upscale for guys like me and you, was it?
Yeah, I didn't even hear of it. That was like when I was a kid living in a tenement. I used to watch TV. I would see Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons. I used to say, where is this? Where do these people live? Where they have backyards and driveways? And
it was just on TV.
It was just on TV.
Like Leave It to Beaver. Ward Cleaver
never
did exist.
I mean, I would watch it religiously, but I didn't. It was like another planet. It was like science fiction. Sure wasn't like Brooklyn.
To us, what was real was the Bowery Boys with Leo Gorsi.
And the Honeymooners.
And the Honeymooners. But it's funny that you say that the Honeymooners. And my wife has a friend, very good friend, and we were talking once, and she made the comment, I don't understand how anybody liked that show, because to me, I found it depressing. And I said, what do you mean you found it depressing? Because it takes place in one room, and they didn't have anything. And I was kind of shocked. Because the woman who said that was
they had love.
But the girl who said that came from very modest means, didn't have anything growing up, and she did well for herself, and she had all earned it. And I said, we all grew up that way. I mean, what you just said, they had love. And it was, they stuck together, they hustled. It, They just made things work. They laughed at their misgivings, if you will. Or
years later, when they remade, they made a feature film and made it an all-black Honeymooners version.
Wasn't that with Cedric, who's a very talented guy,
guy. And I went back to the street where Jackie Gleason grew up. And to the where the apartment building was.
In Bensonhurst.
No, it wasn't. No, it's in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And on Halsey Street.
Right.
And because they used that.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the name of where he lived in the Honeymooners.
But they mixed it up. They said Bensonhurst, but it was actually, then they, for years they said it was Bushwick. It's actually in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Right.
And that block where he lived, where his old man went to the store one day and never came back and left him and his mother alone. It had been torn down, but the house next to it was exactly the same. And I talked to all the people on the block, and they were all African-American, and I was asking them about it. They said, oh, yeah, that's where Jackie Gleason lived. And they were all Honeymooner fans. They all had favorite episodes.
Oh, it's
they all said that the street should be renamed for Jackie Gleason. And they said, well, you know, we'll probably go to see that movie, but it can't possibly be as funny as the original. They should have left it alone.
What was the name of the street?
It was Halsey Street.
Yeah.
And I forget the exact address, but it's in my old column. If you Google my name and the Honeymooners, you'll probably find the old column. And even the crossing guard in the corner, everybody, they started to laugh when they would say their favorite episode, either the sleepwalking one or, you know.
Mine was Captain Video or the golfing. Hello,
yeah,
ball.
Yeah, it was just endless. But they all loved it the same way as everybody else. And Jackie Gleason, you know, found humor in the squalor that he grew up in. And that's where that's where things began for him. And it was his most successful skit. Well, it started as a skit on Cavalcade of Stars, and then it became a weekly series. And I interviewed the Joyce Maynard. What was the name? Joyce Randolph, the one who played Trixie.
Trixie.
Yeah, she was the last living one. I think she's still alive. I interviewed her, and she was a character. She said that Jackie would never socialize with anybody, and he was a perfectionist, and he drove the writers insane. But he had a photographic memory, and you had 2 days to remember the entire thing and perform it in front of a live audience. And look what they got.
You know what you said? They had love, and when you look at it, it was simple. It wasn't complicated.
Love and friendship.
It made love and friendship. And the value of it.
And there was one person on the street said, we're still chasing the same dollar that Ralph and Ed were chasing 50 years ago.
No, you're 100%. And that's what, listen, let my father rest in peace. He always had two jobs, and more times than not, he had three jobs. And you know what? That was the norm. And I guess we're sounding like two old farts here talking, but that's what was the Brooklyn that we grew up in. And we're talking about the Honeymooners. That's what it's about. Maybe, as you say, maybe it was just a simpler time. Maybe that's what it was about. And things with now is a lot more complicated.
But it's a timeless comedy because it was the first show really about working people.
Yeah.
You know, Jackie Gleason played Life O'Reilly on TV for a while.
Yep.
And which was just not as funny, but because that wasn't him. This one was really based on his life.
Well, Dennis, I got to tell you, I'm looking at the clock. I mean, you and I can go for 3.
We're not done yet.
We can go for 3 more hours, but I'm going to have to pull the plug right now. Okay. This has been absolutely
been
a joy.
Fun time on the stoop.
And you know what, buddy? We're going to do the stoop again.
Okay,
all right? You got an open invitation, and I hope you'll accept.
Yeah, sure.
All right. My great thanks to Dennis Hamill. And listen, I want to thank to all of you for getting a load of this today. Now I'd like to get a load of you. Let me know your thoughts. You can contact me on Twitter at Russ Salzberg or on Facebook. You can also get a load of my website real easy. Just go to russsalzberg.com. My thanks today to my producer, Lexi Pevararo, to WABC 77, WABC News Director Craig Schwab, Assistant News Director Matt Dahl, and as always, use people out there, because without use people, I'd have nobody to talk to. So until next time, it is yours truly saying to use people. It's Russ Salzberg saying bidding you a bye-bye, so long, and farewell.